remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading, and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilize some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is, and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development, in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength, the policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race. North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed. and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Ishkuntana and his six-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Ishkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety, rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration, from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that is being ignored. I mean, it's being ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sadr Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and he's still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizza, London.
Lebanon has marked the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation. On this year's anniversary, Beirut was seen to a conference on the resistance front's fight against the world arrogance. The meeting, held by the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, was attended by guests from over 60 countries. The four-day congregation's theme is the resilience of the axis of resistance and its role in breaking the siege, ending sanctions, and overthrowing normalization.
This is more than necessary now to unite the people against this American-Israel aggression, because we have the same problem everywhere. You know this very good from the Middle East. I am from Serbia. We know it as well from the Balkans. But now they start to attack the other European countries because they only use terrorism, like they kill General Soleimani.
Some participants said the liberation of southern Lebanon in 2000 and other victories for the resistance front in the last few decades are catalysts for a shift to a multipolar world.
Definitely, there's been a huge change in the world. Because of the strength of the resistance in our region and the defeat of the American troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is now infecting the whole world in hope to escape American hegemony. So we see even this shift of multipolarity actually started because of the resistance in our region.
Western guests present in the conference believe there is growing awareness on the need for resistance against arrogant powers.
The awareness itself is shaped by resistance. So the actual victories in Palestine, in Syria, in Cuba, in Venezuela, these are the things that really shape people's consciousness. But we in the gathering here want to reinforce the values that people have a proper understanding of the importance of the centrality of resistance for human liberation.
An attendee said the resistance front is capable of putting an end to the Israeli regime's relentless atrocities against Palestinians.
Israel has become now a fascist regime. Israel has become a barbaric and a racist and a totalitarian regime. That is the only country in the world which has been supported by Western hegemony and also NATO. But their time, it is nearer. And the resistance and the people of the world, through the international solidarity movement, they will find ways to dismantle the Israeli apartheid regime.
The delegations will be taking a tour to villages in southern Lebanon. They will also pay an official visit to Syria to show solidarity with Damascus in the face of U.S. sanctions. Major transformations in recent years have caused more and more people to resonate with the values of resistance. Participants here consist of not only Lebanese and Palestinians, but people from around the world who are against the aggressive policies of Israel and the United States. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A successful first launch operation. Iran has test-fired its most advanced ballistic missile.
The fourth-generation Khorram Shah-class long-range ballistic missile dubbed Khaybar is a liquid-fueled precision-guided missile that can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead and accurately hit targets 2,000 kilometers farther.
Khorram Shah 4 is the developed version of previous models and is a stealth missile. It can easily bypass enemy air defenses due to its low radar cross-section. It is the result of years of hard work of our engineers at the Aerospace Industries Organization. With its impressive tactical capabilities, the Khorram Shah 4 missile shows that we are fully committed to defending our country.
Khorram Shah 4 has a unique guidance and control system which allows it to adjust its trajectory as it travels through outer space. The system is deactivated as it re-enters the atmosphere. This important feature makes Khorram Shah 4 missiles fully immune to any kind of electronic warfare counterattacks. The newly unveiled missile also has an incredibly short preparation and launch time, and thanks to its liquid-fueled engine, the missile can easily reach hypersonic speeds of Mach 16 in outer space and Mach 8 traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. This makes detecting and tracking the missile impossible, which means it is totally invisible to radars.
When we talk about our defense capabilities, the name Khorram Shah stands for self-reliance and sacrifice, the two qualities that lead to the liberation of the city of Khorram Shah back in 1982. So this type of missile is rightfully named Khorram Shah. And the fourth generation that was unveiled today marks a significant advancement in Iran's ballistic missile technology while enhancing its defense capabilities and deterrence. This is good news for our nation.
All of this is happening on the 41st anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorram Shah during the Iran-Iraq War, a major turning point that tipped the scales in Iran's favor, designating the word Khorram Shah as a code name for victory, perseverance, and self-reliance.
And what better way to celebrate the liberation anniversary of the city of Khorram Shah than by unveiling this ballistic missile? Khorram Shah 4 is a precision-guided missile which is considered a symbol of determination and self-sufficiency. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in him from the evil of my soul. For surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq Al Said, is in Iran for the first time since becoming the leader of the kingdom in 2020. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi had invited him to Iran during the president's visit to Muscat. Now, the Omani Sultan is leading a high-level delegation for a two-day visit where the two sides will discuss expanding relations. Iran and Iman have a history of good relations, and the two sides would like to see their cooperation expanding even more. We will take a look at the significance of the Sultan of Oman's visit at this time on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of London, Masoud Shankar, a political commentator. And out of Belgrade, John Busnes, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Masoud, let's start off with the significance of this visit by the Sultan in your perspective.
Hi, Mazda. This is really a sort of continuation of an extremely good relation, as you mentioned, between Iran and Oman, and reconfirmation of the continuation that good relation by the new Sultan. This is the first time he's coming to Iran and cementing the good relationship between Oman and Iran that goes many, many years. In reality, history of the region has shown that Iran's best relationship in the region has always been Oman, and this has served both the countries and indeed the security and tranquility of the region. So it is significant to see that this is continuing and is being cemented with the new leadership since 2020.
Okay. Well, John, I mean, your thoughts about the importance of this, especially now that the region is experiencing unprecedented levels of rapprochement between various countries.
Well, I think that this is just another step forward from Iran's perspective, and also it's a stabilizing factor in the entire region. So long as Iran can maintain and expand good relations with a growing number of countries in the region, it means that America and its allies cannot pressure Iran to the extent that they used to try to do. This means that there's a greater likelihood of existing and lasting peace, and it's also a greater likelihood of independent economic development for the entire region.
What about that, Master? You heard what John said, that it means that the United States can pressure Iran less. I mean, we're seeing a growing number of countries either expanding their relations with Iran or reigniting their relations with Iran. Let's talk about the significance of this and what's happening currently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a number of reasons for this. One is people realizing Iran historically has never invaded any of its neighbors. It's been having a very stabilizing relationship. Even with Iraq after the war, at the time of the Iraq war, Iran did play much better friend and neighbor than all those who were supporting Saddam Hussein for many, many years. So that is historical sort of reality. But also I think there is another reality. People in the region and countries in the region who solely depended on the United States are realizing that the United States is not a good friend. The United States actually uses and misuses others for its own sort of benefit, short-term benefit or perceived benefit. And greatest example of that is what they did in Afghanistan, what they did in Iraq, what they did elsewhere in the region, and indeed what they're doing in Ukraine right now. And Ukraine is almost shattered to pieces because of the short-term political agenda of the United States and expansionist concept for the NATO. So people are actually realizing that if they want security, if they want stability, if they want continuation of their interests and the interests of their nation and their citizens, then they should not be as obedient sort of friend or servant to the United States. And that's why we are seeing countries are actually realizing that the only way that they could ensure the security is bypass the propaganda of colonial United States, and indeed sort of trying to establish regional security and regional prosperity economically, politically, socially, and they have a lot more in common. And I think that's one of the reasons we are seeing a shift by Saudi Arabia, Emirates, and everybody else moving away from the United States and trying to be independent because they see no future in being sort of a stooges of the United States. And from Iran's point of view, Iran is holding old allies like Oman on one side and building upon that with the other neighbors, both in the Persian Gulf and also in the north and elsewhere. And I think that is the significant.
Okay, well, what about that, John? I mean, what Masoud said is more and more of these countries are becoming aware that the United States isn't a good friend. I mean, how do you assess a country like Oman? Because, of course, Oman has close ties, historically has close ties with Iran. It also is close to Washington. So how is it able to actually balance those two sides and the importance of this?
Well, there are basically two options that are on the table. A, Oman is attempting to be a more independent country and therefore broadening its contacts in the region to balance the influence of the United States, or, which is commonly the case with American allies, America has permitted Oman to have contact with Iran because America itself realizes that it needs more contact with Iran to get itself out of the mess that it has created in the region for itself. Either option is bad for America's hegemony, and we have to remember that it's been said repeatedly that there's nothing more dangerous than being an enemy of America than to be a friend of America.
Yes, yeah, a very well-known quote these days. It's definitely going around a lot. Well, Masoud, Oman has played over the years the role of mediator between Iran and various Western and Muslim countries. What about this particular visit? Do you think that there is any special meaning behind this visit at the time when the situation in the region is changing so rapidly?
There is. I mean, as I said, this current leader hasn't been to Iran before, so it is significant that he is coming. And the fact of the matter is that there is the change of the mood in the region. I mean, it's not there was a time that Oman was one of the very few countries in a relationship with Iran, and it was always said that that relationship is being encouraged by United States for having a contact, but you're seeing that is not the case now. There is a much, much better relationship with Saudi Arabia, with the Emirates, with Qatar, and the whole region. And the reality is that those countries, including Saudi Arabia, are refusing to be obedient servants of United States when it comes to the price of oil, when it comes to relationship with Russia. And so it really, the significance of this is much, much greater, much wider than just between Iran and sort of the region. And the fact of the matter is that to build upon the good relationship of Oman and then extend it, which is what the policy has been by this present government of Mr. Raisi, it really sort of shows Iran is going into a different league and the times are changing tremendously.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, the times are changing tremendously. Let's talk about those times, John, because as Masoud's saying, we are seeing a lot of changes that are taking place in the region. A lot of, as I said earlier, rapprochement or attempts at that. One of these is actually Oman is in the middle of trying to initiate or rekindle the relationship between Cairo and Tehran. And just a couple of days prior to coming to Iran, the Sultan of Oman was in Egypt. Your take on that side of things and the importance, if you believe that it is important, of close relations or rekindling relations between these two countries.
Absolutely. And I'd like to agree completely with the comments of your other commentator today that, yes, this is bigger than just Oman. This is actually a global shift as the world moves towards multipolarity, as everybody recognizes that the so-called sole superpower, America, is not the sole superpower. And as the petroleum producing nations themselves gather around the resource that they have and realize that there are other buyers who do not ask to have sovereignty over your country for dealing with you in business. Now, as this expands to Egypt, and with the role of Oman in Egypt and Iran, we're seeing it move beyond just the countries which are the main oil producers, but to the other Islamic countries in the region. And this means that we've moved beyond the strict economic basis to an actual cultural and political expansion of multipolarity. And I have to say that not many people expected Iran to be able to do this, and this is a feather in the cap of Iran.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about that, Masoud, because from a strategic perspective, when we look at what is happening, again, in the region, and the strengthening of ties with each other, one would think that the country, for example, the United States and its allies that believe in dividing and separating and causing problems, would not be happy about this and likely targeting regional countries to try to change their perspective. Let's talk about that and the possibilities. On the one hand, if these countries have this solidarity, and also the possible problems, the way the United States may target them. How do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really one of the dangers. The fact is that the United States is in a process of losing his authority and his power. And superpowers, when they're doing that, they're actually the most dangerous. They see it happening every day. And Egypt is actually a great example of that. I mean, I remember at the time of Islamic Awakening, I went to Egypt four times, and I couldn't even make a phone call from Egypt to Iran. I had to go through a third country, you know, to get connected.
No.
Because it was absurd. And this was the power of the United States trying to divide and rule. And they're extremely, I mean, all the reports indicate that the United States and Israel are fuming over this sort of attempt for the Egypt and Iran to get closer. And this is going to happen elsewhere. So this is in some ways, is very exciting time. And in the same time, is a dangerous time, because mm-hmm. United States is going to use all sorts of tricks to create conflict. And many indicating the sort of the situation of Afghanistan right now is something that behind the scene, it's a sort of it's that divide and rule and sort of element coming or trying to show its ugly head. So there has to be very careful, vigilant mm-hmm. At the time like this for these countries to move forward positively, becoming closer to each other. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen, and it's continuing to happen. And these hiccups, if they even manage to organize it, are going to be nothing but hiccups. And I see nothing is going to stop this change of mood. And as the other contributor said, it's not just in the region, but it's globally. And it's happening, and it's very exciting.
Right, yeah, not just in the region, but globally. Now, John, what would you say? I mean, because this has been happening over the years, various situations that countries have seen, the hegemon in various wars. But what would you say was the main force behind this change right now? Many would say the situation with Russia and Ukraine, and then the way that the United States and its allies basically had frozen Russia funds, and then more and more countries start thinking, well, it could be us too tomorrow, anytime Washington disagrees. I mean, do you see that as the main force behind all this, or your overall assessment?
Well, I would say that that could be called the final chapter of the development that's been taking place, but we've got two other elements that that actually must have weighed in very heavily on this. We have to recall that there used to be a country or united state called the United Arab Republic, which united Syria and Egypt together as allies and as one functioning state. So it would imply that the growing influence and the great aid that Iran has given to Syria in resisting the ISIS operation run by the United States, the proxy war in Syria, and the effort to topple the leadership of Syria has also opened the door to Syria-Egypt rapprochement. And that's probably taking place under the covers here. And at the same time, Egypt knows the writing is on the wall because of what happened in Libya. So Egypt is seeing itself in a situation where it's looking at its own historic past, its own historic past alliances, and realizing that actually, out of all of this, the one country that has stood still and defended itself and survived all of this is only Iran. So Iran is now building a linkage that ties together Arab nations, that ties together the experience of Libya, and ties together the regional interests of all of the countries around this permanent war zone, which is what America has created with its support for Israel. This is a very, very important strategic step that has at least three factors: Syria, Libya, and Israel all being dealt with and these problems being resolved by Iran's initiative. It is a historic moment indeed.
What about that, Massoud? I mean, at the bottom line, is it that Iran in this 44 years with all of the problems and sanctions and attempted coups and anything we can just about say that existed has been thrown at Iran over the last four decades. And despite this, standing strong, continuing to strengthen, do you think that the regional countries finally got it? Because in the beginning, there was a lot of trying to divide. Of course, this isn't the old English rule of divide and conquer, whether it's between ethnicities, nationalities, religion, whatever. Have we matured in the region enough to get over minor differences, concentrate on what we have in common, and help to improve each country in the region by being strong and by being united? Do you think that we're there yet, Massoud, or how do you see it?
We are in that process. I mean, we talked about how United States cannot be trusted. You know, you look at Libya, you could look at you know, what they did in Afghanistan, and it goes on and on and on, and Ukraine and so forth. And exact opposite is actually the position of Iran's friendship, be it with Syria or be it in Lebanon or be it anywhere else, in Iraq, etc., etc. It's been a friendship, it's been a support, which has been unconditional, and it has been total. And especially, you know, for groups like Palestinians. I mean, the fact of the matter is not based on sort of fecking of being supporting Shias or Sunnis and so forth. People have been supported because they needed the support. That has been exactly in contrast what United States has done. But I think also we need to recognize what happened in Qatar at the World Cup. I mean, there was an awakening. I mean, Zion and Palestinian cause was the real winner. All these nations, they realized, despite all their spend, despite normalization on the level of the governments and ministers and emirs and so forth, ordinary people right across the region are supporting Palestine even more than what they have done or what they was taught. And I think that was also a wake-up call for these governments in the region, that they can't really go against that sort of popularity for a cause within their own population and try to depend on Israeli support or U.S. support and so forth. So there is a combination of everything that is bringing that level of awareness that indeed, if they've got even any sort of intellect, they should see that their future and the future of their country and indeed their leadership depends on this shift that has to take place.
And John, we just have less than a minute actually left right now, about 30 seconds. How do you see it with the situation that Masoud had just talked about? Are you optimistic about the West Asian region, the future? How do you see it?
I am very optimistic. You know, I'm a believing Christian. And if you look back 20 or 30 years ago, there would be very few believing Christians who would be supporting unity among Arabs, among Muslims, and so on. But there are so many of us who have opened our eyes, who have seen that this is a perpetual war by a godless America. They don't believe in God. They believe in their warfare and their God, which is mammon. And that is just money. And profit put before people will always result in a collapse. They are on their way down, and the rest of the world is on their way up.
And on that note, I thank both of you being with me on this program. Masoud Chowdhury, pleasure always, political commentator out of London. John Bosnich, wonderful having you as always, out of Belgrade, journalist, activist, and political analyst. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Gun violence is always a critical topic during U.S. elections, but experts see little hope in the U.S. political circle to address the issue due to its historical complexity and the extremely polarized stances of Democrats and Republicans, even as gun-related tragedies continue to occur in the United States of America. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more, please. Global Times noted, in the latest reflection of the miserable situation over the past week, Alabama witnessed another mass shooting tragedy in the U.S., with 4 deaths and 28 injuries, while the potential Republican presidential candidates still reportedly rejected the idea of more restrictions that could curb the bloodshed as they spoke at the annual gathering of the National Rifle Association, NRA. The Alabama shooting happened the same day that shots were fired into a crowd at a park in Louisville, Kentucky. 2 people were killed and 4 others were wounded. That incident was the city's second mass shooting in less than a week. On April 10th, a gunman killed five people and injured several others at Louisville's Old National Bank, according to CNN. According to data released by the Gun Violence Archive, GVA, across the U.S., a total of 157 mass shootings have happened this year as of April 16th, indicating an average of 1.48 cases per day during this period. These shootings have resulted in 12,358 deaths, with 413 aged under 17, and 9,600 injuries, according to data updated recently. But former President Donald Trump still insisted that this is not a gun problem in his speech recently during NRA annual gathering. Mike Pence, Trump's vice president, also towed the line by saying that people should stop trampling on the God-given rights of the American people every time a tragedy happens, according to a New York Times report recently. Liu Xiang, research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social, pointed out that the issue has been totally politicized and became a label of partisan conflict in the U.S. Liu told the Global Times recently, "In the U.S., the Democrats have to call for banning or managing guns, while Republicans will definitely stress freedom in owning guns. It's as if they're not Democrats or Republicans if they do not stick to the party's stance. Such polarized stances have resulted in there being no space for the two parties to negotiate over the issue, which Liu deemed as the main reason why the problem of gun violence in the U.S. cannot be resolved as its root. This is a typical systematic problem of the United States," Liu noted. The Insider reported, during the NRA annual meeting, photos of children handling firearms also made the rounds on U.S. social media platforms over the weekend, even though the association said that they had rendered the guns at the exhibitions incapable of being fired. Gun control advocates slammed the scene as saying responsible gun owners and parents would not allow a child to put their finger on a firearm's trigger while pointing it at other people, even if they are props. Yuan Zheng, deputy director and a senior fellow of the Institute of American Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, said that even though gun violence is always a critical issue during the U.S. elections, they will not play a decisive role. Gun violence is a complicated issue combining historical and partisan elements as well as social factors. The current polarized U.S. politics is making it even more difficult to solve the problem, which is actually pathetic and indicates the government's lack of capability, according to Yuan. The U.S. government's inability to address this mission impossible has laid bare the decline of U.S. governance capacity, according to a report China released in February, revealing the truth and facts of rampant U.S. gun violence. In June 2022, U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law what was reportedly the most sweeping legislation aimed at preventing gun violence in 30 years. Biden called the signing of the legislation a monumental day and said it was proof that Democrats and Republicans could find common ground on important issues. However, experts see this so-called gun deal as one that just scratches the surface, as it falls short of the essence of gun control measures expected by the public, such as prohibiting the manufacture, transfer, and possession of semi-automatic assault weapons, and the transfer and possession of large-capacity ammunition feeding devices, and a change to the age at which a person needs to be to purchase an assault-style weapon. They deemed the agreement as being just a joint political show put on by the Democrats and Republicans to trick the public and win votes during the midterm elections, amid an outcry over gun violence following the killing of at least 19 children and 2 teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, on May 24, 2022.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.